Let's go ahead and get started. So Oliver DeWolf will be speaking today. His title is Stability of ADS-P times MQ Compactifications Without Supersymmetry, or Why Igor Klebanov Does Agree to Believe in Bosonic M Theory.
Thank you, Steve.
The second part.
It's not officially on the transparency. Okay, well, thanks. It's always nice to speak in front of a hometown crowd. I thank the organizers for inviting me to speak. Only one of them is actually here, but to in absentia. So, as Steve said, the title of my talk is Stability of ADS Cross M Compactifications Without Supersymmetry, and this was work done in collaboration with Dan Friedman, who is here, Steve Gubser at Caltech, his student Indrajit Mitra, who's at Princeton, and Gary Horowitz, who is also in absentia today. So, a few words of introduction about studying ADS compactifications and stability thereof. So, as we all know, compactifications of anti de Sitter space cross some generic Einstein manifold, compact Einstein manifold, supported by flux. These backgrounds have been very popular in supergravity, string theory, M theory lately. Most of the familiar examples involve supersymmetry, and they're all perturbatively stable. They're stable to small fluctuations in a way which we'll discuss momentarily. And in fact, they either saturate or in some cases nearly saturate the Brightman-Friedman bound for stability of scalar fluctuations in anti de Sitter space, which allows certain tachyonic, apparently tachyonic scalar fields nonetheless to exist in the theory without it becoming unstable, as we'll discuss momentarily. So it is of interest to study more general backgrounds without supersymmetry and wonder about the connection between supersymmetry and stability. So if you find more general backgrounds of this sort, you could imagine that if they in fact are the classical backgrounds that can be completed to a full quantum gravitational system, then they would have to have some sort of conformal field theory dual, presumably more exotic conformal field theories. Another issue is to study whether there's an analog of a mass greater than charge bound for black p-brains, something which I think a lot of people think should exist, but hasn't actually been proven. These sorts of backgrounds are of course, the near horizon geometries of such black p-brains, possibly on a Ricci flat cone. Then another motivation, which is the first motivation, alluded to elliptically by Steve Giddings in his introduction, is the proposed bosonic M theory. It's a 27-dimensional bosonic completion of the bosonic string, which is supposed to have, if it exists, certain brains whose near horizon geometries should give rise to backgrounds like this. And it was objected by certain parties that these backgrounds should in fact prove to be unstable since they don't possess supersymmetry. The ones we're familiar with ride on the edge of disaster by having modes that are almost on, or in fact on, the line of marginal stability. So it was speculated that in fact, as soon as you remove supersymmetry from the game, that everything will go awry and that these backgrounds will be unstable. So that was proposed as one reason why bosonic M theory is wrong. As we'll see, this in fact is not the reason. Couple more issues which are a little more particular. There is a solution of massive type 2A supergravity, which is the low energy limit of backgrounds with D8 brains in type 2A string theory, which is ADS-4 cross S6. This has no supersymmetry. It was written down by Romans in his original paper about the massive 2A theory. So we decided it would be interesting to investigate the stability of this because it's a little more interesting than these generic backgrounds in that it has a bare cosmological constant and a dilaton. And then finally, even more recently than our paper, it has been brought to my attention that there has been speculation that backgrounds like this, but involving a bare positive cosmological constant, that is the sign that would give you de Sitter space in a sort of trivial background, that these backgrounds could violate the N bound that was hypothesized by Raphael Busso to extend the work of Tom Banks to all spaces with a positive cosmological constant. So it would be of interest to see whether or not these backgrounds are in fact unstable, in which case they might no longer play the role of spoilers for that bound. So we're going to look at all of these issues in the process, and to sort of keep in our minds that we're investigating how much these issues of stability depend on the presence of supersymmetry. So let's go ahead and analyze perturbative stability for these cases. So, hopefully it is not a tactical error to attempt, before getting into what we did, to review a little bit the Brighton-Lohner-Friedman bound, which is a bound on the mass of scalar fields which still lead to stable fluctuations in anti-de-Sitter space. And I'll just go through this, not in great detail, but just to give a flavor. There's a lot of different ways one can see this bound. This is the one that was originally used by Brighton-Lohner-Friedman. So one can define an energy functional in a curved space that has a global time-like Killing vector. This is the global time-like Killing vector here. This is essentially just the analog of taking T00 of the stress tensor and integrating it over a space-like hypersurface. It divides up into a part that involves fluctuations of the metric, which we won't deal with because we know that metric fluctuations of anti-de-Sitter space are themselves stable. That was proven a long time ago. And a part that involves fluctuations of the stress tensor. You subtract out the stress tensor in the background such that this energy is zero when you're dealing with no fluctuations. So this object here is formally conserved in the background metric thanks to the Bianchi identity and the condition that this is a Killing vector. And so the requirement for stability is that given the set of all fluctuations whose energy converges, that energy must be positive. For example, one considers a real scalar field in Minkowski space. This, the integrand here, just becomes the familiar Hamiltonian, which has kinetic terms and a mass term. And if you take, for example, the following initial data, which is just an exponential function times an overall constant, and also on the initial surface set the time derivative to be zero, you find this value for the energy. And you can see that if m squared is positive, then this is always positive. But if m squared happens to be negative, you can always choose an a such that this gives you a negative, in effect, by tuning phi naught, an arbitrarily large negative energy fluctuation. So this is just deriving what's very intuitive, which is that stability of Minkowski space requires that there aren't any tachyonic scalar fields. Now, in anti-de-Sitter space, story is a little more subtle. So consider an anti-de-Sitter solution where there's also a scalar field present. Let's write down the theory here. Gravity, a cosmological constant, and a massive scalar. This is a given metric for anti-de-Sitter space. In this metric, the time-like Killing vector is just given simply like that. And then let's consider a fluctuation of a scalar field around it. Well, there are a number of terms, some time derivatives, some angular derivatives. We're not going to consider these. These are manifestly positive. And then derivative of the radial coordinate times the scalar, and then also a mass term. Now, obviously, if the mass is greater than zero, then each and every one of these terms is positive definite, so one doesn't have to worry. However, if this is negative, it seems like one term is negative, the others are positive, and we don't, at first, know what's going on. But actually, Brighton-Lohner and Friedman showed is that you can redefine the scalar by pulling out a factor of the radial coordinate to some power mu, which is specified later. And then just the last two terms involving the radial derivative and the mass term break into several pieces. There's actually a boundary term here, and then a couple of bulk terms. And what one does is one notices that if you choose this mu parameter, which you introduced arbitrarily, to be related to the mass and the dimension in this particular way, then this whole term, even if this is negative, and this term is also negative because of the redefinition we did, this whole term just collapses to a constant. Basically, it becomes 1 minus sine squared over cosine squared. So the bulk terms, in fact, reduce to something that's positive definite. So remember, for stability, what we needed was that all fluctuations with convergent norm were positive. You can show that in order to get convergent norm, the scalar fluctuations have to vanish at least this fast, And in that case, the boundary term that we had in the last transparency vanishes. So all you're left with is a sum of manifestly positive definite terms, and it seems like even with an arbitrary negative mass, you've shown that you can rewrite it through field redefinition as something explicitly positive definite. So it seems you've proven stability, but in fact, one can't do this for any value of the mass, because in order to define this mu parameter, mu is related to the dimension and the mass in this way, and since the mass can be negative, if the argument of the square root here goes negative, then mu itself is a complex number. We haven't really shown anything. This type of positive, negative, even imaginary pieces. So the transformation is only valid if the mass is not so negative that it makes this whole argument go negative. And that turns out to be that it has to be greater than or equal to minus p minus 1 squared, where p is the dimension of the space, over 4. And this is the Brayton-Lohner-Friedman bound. This is sort of the simplest derivation. There are other derivations, ones that are more sophisticated, but they all come back to the same thing. So we're going to find that when analyzing stability in anti-de Sitter space, we don't need to require that scalar fields are in fact positive mass, but just that their mass exceeds this particular number here.
Just a quantum interest. If phi is complex, can you make mu to be complex so that you can violate the bound, or is there some other solution?
Well, if you made mu complex here, then, well, the energy should be real.
Yeah, okay. If you have phi star phi.
If you have phi star phi, then, okay, so, let's see.
Well, you should be able to take phi star phi and divide it up into two real fields.
Yeah. I mean, in this particular analysis, at worst what you show is that the field redefinition that you did is not going to work. There are more sophisticated analyses that actually show that more negative masses, in fact, never give you a stable configuration.
However, you might mention that intuition just comes from the uncertainty principle. These global coordinates where the radial coordinate has finite range because of the cosine rho factor, you just have the kinetic energy is forced to exceed the negative potential energy because the wave function has to curve down fast enough toward the boundary. And I think that's a good physical reason for this.
Good.
How do you see through that?
Well, it's really particle in a box.
You have a potential.
Again, there's a boundary condition in the box. A normalizable fluctuation, the wave function has to vanish at a certain rate in the box.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a competition between positive kinetic energy and potential energy, which is negative when the mass is negative.
Mm-hmm.
And the argument we went through proves that the kinetic energy wins. So you get overall positivity.
As long as you're satisfied.
All right. So let's now move to the main computation. So most of what I'll talk about is considering spaces that are solutions to Einstein gravity coupled to a Q-form field strength. This particular action admits so-called Freund-Rubin solutions of the equations of motion, which are product space of anti-de Sitter space and any arbitrary compact Einstein manifold, which we call M sub Q, and this is supported by flux proportional to the volume form of the Einstein manifold. One can imagine, in principle, adding other fields here that aren't turned on in the background. That's another story. But we're going to examine the fluctuations that result from these fields around the background. So these are just some conventions. The ADS has dimension P, the compact space has dimension Q, the total dimension we call D. L squared and R squared are the characteristic lengths of anti-de Sitter space and of the Einstein space. And then solving the Einstein equations, which I wrote here, require relationships between the three massive parameters, that is the value of the flux, the strength of the flux, and the two length scales of the spaces. So this is a Freund-Rubin solution. We're considering fluctuations around this solution. So this is just to get some conventions and notations straight. Mu and nu, by the way, are indices in the anti-de Sitter direction, alpha and beta are indices in the compact directions. So we expand the fluctuations of the metric in terms of gravitons. It's a standard convention in the Olkaluza-Klein literature to perform the so-called linearized vial shift, where you subtract off something proportional to the trace of the compact graviton from the ADS graviton. It just simplifies the equations of motion. We also have fluctuations of the field strength. And we impose certain gauge conditions. So it's like a de Donder gauge. The parentheses in our notation represents not just symmetrized, but also symmetrized with the trace removed. So these divergences are both zero. And then also require that the divergence on the compact space of the gauge potential with the other indices, anything, either on the Einstein space or on the ADS space, is zero. This is equivalent to this in form notation. And this basically means that you can always expand this guy. So generically, by the Hodge decomposition theorem, you can expand a differential form in exact, coexact, and harmonic pieces, and this constraint kills one of them, and you're left with just these two. This is all of this that I'm talking about here is cohomology with respect to the compact space only. The other indices in anti de Sitter space just go along for the ride. And so, once we have defined our fluctuations, we expand them in spherical harmonics. You won't be required to memorize this. It's just to give flavor. These are the various modes of the graviton. I'll remind you what they are when they come up later. And various modes of the potential. I know this looks a little confusing, but the point is that we're able to expand it in coexact modes as well as in harmonic modes. So for example, this is a harmonic mode, and this is a coexact mode. And then the basic procedure for what we need to do is to take the Einstein and form equations, linearize them around the background, expand in these modes that I've written down here, and then collect the coefficients of any given spherical harmonic, or tensor spherical harmonic, and require the coefficients of the independent ones to vanish. So that involves some pain. So just take a moment to imagine something you find particularly painful. I am not going to put you through it. And I'll jump directly to the answers and the analysis of the answers. Let me say first that we find two coupled systems of modes. So the traces of both the ADS and the compact gravitons mix with the fluctuation of the Q-form field around the background. These are all scalars from the point of view of anti de Sitter space, and these are the most complicated system. We also find the graviphoton mixing with the mode of the potential that has one anti de Sitter index. So those are the more complicated cases to treat. Other modes are decoupled in the sense that they don't have any other field in their linearized field equation. There's some symmetric tensors, some other p-form fields, which I'll mention just very briefly. And then actually a very interesting set of modes that results from the graviton with both indices on the compact space, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And just to say a few words about what expectations we might have had before we actually go to the answers that we found, we had thought, sort of naively ahead of time, or one might think ahead of time, that the modes most likely to violate the Brayton-Lunar-Friedman bound, if anything violates it, would be coupled scalar modes. And why is that? Well, if you have an uncoupled scalar mode, which just descends from some field in higher dimensional space, and it was massless in the higher dimensional space, you might imagine that in the lower dimension, it's either going to be massless, or the more you turn on complicated dependence on the compact space, it will get a positive mass, as is usual in Klutz-Klein reduction. But we might expect that nothing would, in fact, give it a negative mass shift. However, when we have a system of coupled scalars, things can happen because the mass terms are not diagonal. There's some matrix that you have to diagonalize. It will introduce, you know, plus and minus some square root of a factor, and the minus sign, you could imagine, would drag you down below the bound. So these seem like the most dangerous modes to deal with. One interesting surprise, though, is that when you do this analysis for arbitrary compact Einstein manifold, MQ, you find that these modes, in fact, almost all of the modes of the system don't care at all about the exact Einstein manifold that you've chosen. They depend only on its dimension, because the only thing that actually enters is the Ricci tensor, which we can write just in terms of its dimension and the radius of the space, which is then in turn determined in terms of the ADS radius by the equations of the background. And actually, these modes here, which are not coupled to anything else and seem sort of innocent, they're the only ones that do depend on the details of the compact space. And we'll come back to that later, see that these modes aren't so innocent after all.
Okay, so these don't depend on the details, but they do have negative masses?
They do have negative masses.
Okay, but always have zero.
But, well, that's what I'll come to now. So let's talk first about this sector of coupled scalars. So there are a number of field equations here, which, again, you don't have to memorize, but just so you can see. It's an equation relating this, the trace of the compact graviton to the field B. There's another equation resulting from the form equation. And then finally, there's a constraint, which directly relates the trace on the anti de Sitter space to the trace on the compact space. There's no derivatives involved. So for the general case, which is when this spherical harmonic and its derivatives does not vanish, then this constraint holds. One can use it in these two equations. And you get this matrix as a mass matrix. I indicated a few conventions there on the sideboard in case you're interested in going through them yourself. Basically, box X and box Y are the Laplacians, the ordinary Laplacians on the anti de Sitter and the compact space. So this is just saying that basically the Laplacian acting on either one of these two fields is equal to some stuff proportional to those two fields. So this is going to give you the mass terms once you diagonalize the 2x2 matrix. And we've written this lambda, which is the eigenvalue of the Laplacian on the compact space. Spherical harmonics are eigenvectors of that Laplacian. And we took out a minus sign since this Laplacian can be shown to be negative definite. So the lambdas are in fact positive definite. And then we also pulled out this length scale. So for any given spherical harmonic, you'll have a different value of lambda. You'll get a whole tower of masses depending on which spherical harmonic you choose. So you go ahead and diagonalize this. And the mass eigenvalues are indicated on top. Like I said, there's going to be two towers, one where you choose the plus sign and one where you choose the minus sign here. Now, the plus sign tower, which I've drawn here, is manifestly positive all the way. It eventually approaches something linear in lambda and just goes off. So it's not anything we have to worry about for the sake of stability. The lower branch, however, has a minus sign, so we might wonder. But if you do the analysis, you find that it has a single minimum on the range that we're interested in. And in fact, that minimum exactly saturates the Brayton-Lehner-Friedman bound all the time. So it doesn't matter what the dimension of the anti de Sitter space is, the dimension of the compact space. In fact, it doesn't even matter what Einstein manifold that compact space is. This curve always exactly hits that bound before going back up to infinity.
There's a simple explanation for that?
Well, I guess it depends on what you think is simple. I mean, one might say, is there a simple explanation for why it's stable, or a simple explanation for why it exactly comes down to the bound?
Well, either.
I would say the simple explanation for why it seems to be stable is that these are the near horizon geometries of charged p-brains. And from the point of view of classical general relativity coupled to a field strength, there's no reason why those things should be unstable. In fact, one might even expect them to be. As to why it exactly saturates the bound, I don't think I have a good explanation for why, other than that it does.
The value for lambda is the same. I mean, that, that's a function of p.
Lambda?
Yeah, I mean, that's an eigenvalue.
Lambda is an eigenvalue of the compact space. So it doesn't depend on p at all. And then, so okay, Eric's question actually leads into something that I need to say anyway, which is that, so when you pick a particular compact space, only discrete values of lambda are actually realized. They are the eigenvalues of the Laplacian on the spherical harmonics. So you might get them somewhere along this curve, but not necessarily at every point on the curve. And which ones are realized will depend on the choice of compact space. The fact that it's stable doesn't depend on it. I should just mention that I extended the top tower all the way down to zero, and the bottom one I sort of stopped at some point. And there's a reason for that, which is that, remember, I said that this analysis involved assuming that certain spherical harmonics and their derivatives were not vanishing. There are special cases for the very lowest lying spherical harmonics, which are a constant or whose second derivatives vanish, for example, that you have to do separately. And you discover the amusing fact that, in fact, all it does is extend the top tower down, but the bottom tower just stops. So one of the two modes disappears in those very low lying spherical harmonics. It's related to a residual gauge invariance, which I don't really need to go into. But so this tower ends up just going to zero while this one starts somewhere above it. Let me specialize to the case of the compact space being a sphere. So in that case, the lambdas are just k times k plus q minus 1. For the two-sphere, this is the usual k times k plus 1 that you remember from angular momentum and all that. Here, k is a whole number, which at least when I was in school meant something, an integer that's zero or positive. And then, we were taught that a sort of blackboard bold n is the natural numbers, which is 1 and up. The whole numbers add 0, and then the integers add the negative numbers. I've never been able to use it in a scientific setting before, but there it is. So you can explicitly evaluate the formula for the masses. You find that in this case, remember there was a square root. It turns out the argument of the square root is a perfect square. And you get this formula where the upper choice is for the lower of the two towers. Upper choice is the lower one. And in this case, the minimum that we were just discussing arises at the value of k, which is equal to q minus 1 over 2. So what this actually means is that for spheres in particular, whether or not you have a physical state sitting at the BF bound depends on whether the dimension of the compact space is even or odd. If it's odd, then you can actually find an integer k such that this minimum corresponds to a physical state. For example, here's ADS4 cross S7, which we all know and love, and it has a state right at the bound. But if the compact space is even, then you find that there is no state at the bound, since this would have to be a half integer. Instead, there's one, or generically two, right above it. So here I plotted ADS7 cross S4. There are a few in the lower tower. What this x means is that if this tower continued down further, this is where the next integer state would be. It's not actually there for ADS7 cross S4, but it might be for other spaces with an even dimensional compact space. But there's no state where the circle is. That would correspond to k equals 1.5. So the lowest line modes are right above the bound. This will come back to haunt us much later. So to keep things real interesting, mix them up a little, I'm going to talk about CFT duals of this before I go back to the other modes of the compactification. So, as we all know, when one has quantum gravity or string theory in a space that looks like anti-de Sitter space times some compact manifold, one can find, by general principles of holography, a conformal field theory dual. And we're going to let D be the dimension of that conformal field theory. It's one less than the dimension of the anti-de Sitter space. And there's a general formula that's been known forever, or at least for 3 years, for the conformal dimensions of the operator's dual to scalars. This is what it is, given the mass. Moreover, there's a bound on the conformal dimensions of dual operators set by unitarity, has to be greater than or equal to d over 2 minus 1. And a consequence of this unitarity bound, this is a familiar story, is that when m squared l squared is sufficiently large, when it's greater than this, which is just one unit above the BF bound, one is forced to choose the delta plus value because the delta minus value would lie below the unitarity bound in the dual CFT. But when the mass lies in this window between the BF bound and this ambiguity bound, then it's actually possible to choose either one. This is first discussed by Klebanoff and Witten. And in fact, there are cases. This was first discussed in the modern era by Klebanoff and Witten. And there are certain cases where, in fact, one is forced to choose both. I'll discuss just one of them, which is ADS4 cross S7. Or I guess I should remark first that although one can, in a sense, one feels like one can choose one or the other, it's part of the definition of the theory which one you choose. And from the point of view of the anti-de Sitter space, you're choosing boundary conditions, and that's part of the definition of what it means to do time evolution of the scalar fields. And of course, from the point of view of the CFT, you have this operator or that operator, but not both. And when there's supersymmetry present, it often helps you out with how you're going to make your choice. That's how ADS4 cross S7 was done, because one can show, for example, with chiral primaries, conformal dimension is related to the R charge, and the R charge has to add, so the conformal dimension ends up having to add, and one requires a linear spectrum. So this is what happens in ADS4 cross S7. These are the states that we have in the gravity side. You can see this orange line is this ambiguity bound. So all of these guys could be given either a delta plus or a delta minus choice, but supersymmetry mandates that this one is delta minus and the rest is delta plus, so that they form a nice linear spectrum of conformal dimensions, which is consistent with their R charge. This one exactly saturates the unitarity bound. So one might start to wonder, however, whether a nice, pretty linear picture like this is generically possible for all of these ADSP cross, for example, S, Q examples. And it turns out not to be so. I'm assuming that the compact space is SQ for this discussion, just for simplicity. And one nice thing is that one finds that, in general, passing from the mass to the conformal dimension involves a perfect square. So there are no square roots left, just have these nice formulas. For M, for the positive tower, the higher tower, you always have to choose delta plus, but you have a choice sometimes for the more negative tower. And this ambiguous region occurs for values of k that satisfies this relation. Now, strange things can happen here. When the dimension of the compact space is sufficiently large compared to this number, what one finds is that not only scalars with very large k, so very large values of the index of the spherical harmonics, rise above this ambiguity bound, but also scalars with small k rise above it. And it turns out that a linear spectrum for dual conformal dimension is impossible. A nice example of this is ADS9 cross S9. It actually also happens for ADS4 cross S23, which is maybe of more interest. I just chose this one basically because the numbers work out nicely and there aren't so many states that it completely clutters the transparency. But this is a generic phenomenon, which is that one has, as you can see, not just this tower going all the way up, but it sort of curves back at the bottom end and gets above this ambiguity bound. And that means that although all of these are required to be delta plus, and you have some choice with the ones that lie in the bound here, there is one, or generically for other spaces there can be more, that here you're once again forced to choose the larger value.
So why do we, without supersymmetry, why are we expecting the linear relation between delta and...
Right, without supersymmetry, there's no reason why there must be a linear relation.
And in particular, but, you draw a green line and said this is the unitarity bound, that's... Oh, wait, which...
No, the unitarity bound is just true for a conformal field theory.
Oh, okay.
Is this not clear? So this The upper graph is in the gravity picture. These are masses. The lower graph is in the dual conformal field, the putative dual conformal field theory. These are conformal dimensions.
Right.
And I'm just indicating with solid circles.
In the super conformal field theory, the linear relation is dictated by a unitarity bound in the super conformal algebra.
Okay. This is just a unitarity bound in the conformal algebra.
Conformal.
Mm-hmm.
Fine, okay.
Right, there's no supersymmetry here. And indeed, it's not obvious that one needs a linear spectrum here, but that would have been the more intuitive expectation, just because one is used to these modes being associated with operators of the form, for example, in ADS5 plus S5. These are trace x to the k, where x is the scalar field associated to the position of the brain in the transverse space. And one's intuition says that as one adds more x's in here in this trace, that the conformal dimension should only go up and up.
Yeah, but
this tells us that
you only imply the inequality where the conformal dimension has to be equal or greater than linear slope in k. So that would mm-hmm. fit with that as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you draw this linear line, then all of them fit into that.
They're greater than the linear line.
Yeah, they're
right.
Greater than linear.
So I'm certainly not claiming that this is inconsistent with conformal field theory. I'm just claiming that it's not the simplest thing that one might imagine, where the dimensions just add. You can certainly imagine a CFT that looks like this.
But there are some other operators which lies above that.
Mm-hmm.
You just pick particular class, the one which has lowest amount of data.
Oh, sure, sure. It's just that these represent a particular sequence
yeah.
of operators.
So, but there are other operators which all lies above the linear line.
Sure.
There are no operators, I believe, which are below those linear lines.
So you would claim that, for example, this
yeah.
state should be ruled out.
Right.
Okay.
And it's ruled out, right?
Mm-hmm. The analysis that I did here, it doesn't rule out.
Oh, it doesn't rule out?
No.
Oh, okay. So it's even there are even operators below the line.
So is that, does that come from the superconformal aspect that you're talking about?
No. But for example, I don't have an intuition in higher dimensional case, but in, for example, in two-dimensional CFT,
mm-hmm.
if there is a current, even if there is no supersymmetry,
mm-hmm.
You can always decompose the conformal field theory into a part which carries the current charge and the one which doesn't carry current charge.
Okay.
So then you would expect some kind of inequality for the which gives a bound for the conformal wave for given charge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do not know, what, probably there is something like that in higher dimension as well. I do not know.
Yeah, but that's a quadratic bound, not a linear.
Yeah, I agree. But there are some bounds, and but this operator.
Is there a Sugawara construction beyond two dimensions?
Yes, that's why I said that I know. I stated explicitly that I'm referring to
yeah,
two dimensions.
That's right. Yeah, but two things. One is it's a quadratic bound. It's two, I'm not sure whether they have it above two dimensions.
Right. All right. Well, are there any more questions about dual CFTs? If not, I'll move on to the vector fluctuation. So the story for the coupled vectors is also a nice one. I can go through this pretty quickly. Basically, these are the two equations of motion, and these two correspond to constraints. So I wrote max. This is just the Maxwell operator in Anti de Sitter space. This is the Hodge-Durham-Laplacian on the compact space. This delta sub y. And proceeding analogously, we have this sort of 2x2 matrix, which involves the mass terms. Kappa here is analogous to the lambda we had before. I think I defined this on the sideboard. This is just the eigenvalue of the Hodge-Durham-Laplacian acting on spherical harmonics. One finds this particular formula for the masses, which is not something you need to know the details of, but what's nice about it is one can show on a general compact Einstein space with positive cosmological constant that these kappas, the eigenvalues of the Laplacian, are bounded below by this particular number, and they only saturate their lower value for when the spherical harmonic that they act on is in fact a killing vector. These spherical harmonics we're dealing with are actually vector spherical harmonics. So one can actually show that the negative branch of this mass formula, when the spherical harmonic is a killing vector, gives you exactly zero, which means that for each killing vector on the compact manifold, you get a massless vector, which is exactly what you would expect, and that all others give you positive masses. So there are no negative mass vectors here, regardless of the nature of the compact space. And in fact, these other equations give you exactly the vanishing of the divergence that you need for massive vectors. So it all works out just right, at least on the gravity side. The CFT picture, there's a little less to say here, because things don't work out as nicely. Again, this is not ruling out that there is a conformal field theory that's dual to it. But one finds, for example, taking SQ, this is the value for the eigenvalue of the Laplacian, and the masses for a generic state in the gravity side, as well as the conformal dimensions for dual operators, are generically irrational. It becomes rational for the familiar cases of ADS4 across S7, et cetera, but generically it's just irrational. So there's not a lot that we can really say about them. Again, this doesn't rule out having a dual conformal field theory. It's just a little less pretty than the supersymmetric ones we're used to. Excuse me?
What about the massive supergravity one?
The massive supergravity one? We'll get to that in a little bit. So let me just say a few words about other fields, which had much simpler equations of motion, because they were not coupled to things. There are tensors, symmetric tensors, which include the ADS graviton at the bottom of the tower. There are more forms with more ADS indices, some massive ones, and also massless ones that were associated to harmonic forms on the compact space. And it's straightforward to show that all of these guys are also stable. One interesting generalization that I just wanted to mention for a second is that one can add a Chern-Simons term to the original action that one dealt with. This is something that we do have, for example, in 11-dimensional supergravity, so it's sort of interesting to ask about it. Now, it's only possible to do it when you can find an integer n such that the dimension of the compact space and of the anti-de Sitter space are related like this. Otherwise, you can't make a term that has p plus q dimensions out of 1a and a series of f's. Moreover, if you can do that, it's only if this n is actually equal to 2 that the action you get affects the linearized analysis that we did. Otherwise, it would only come into higher order fluctuations. But for n equals 2, you can actually go through this, show that there's only one mode that gets affected. It's the one of these coexact forms that doesn't couple to anything else, that has all its indices on the anti-de Sitter space. And in fact, it's non-tachyonic for any value of the coefficient, for any value of the Chern-Simons coupling constant that you put in. So without supersymmetry, it's not really clear whether you want a Chern-Simons term or not. One would need other reasons. But if you do add one, it's completely harmless from the point of view of stability or instability of the system. And now, let me discuss the remaining fluctuations, the ones that earlier on I said looked kind of innocent, but actually turn out to be not so innocent. These are these scalar fields, which we called phi, which are just the graviton with both indices on the compact space and the trace removed. And the equation of motion, all you really need to know about the equation that they satisfy is that it involves the Riemann tensor on the compact space. Unlike all the other modes, the details of the compact space do enter into the analysis here, because you need more than the Ricci tensor. You need the actual Riemann tensor. So that's interesting. These are a little more, these can shift their shape from one compact space to another. And in fact, we can show, if you choose the sphere, we obviously know the Riemann tensor for that, that these are, in fact, always positive mass modes. So that means at this point, we've now proven that to small fluctuations, ADSP cross SQ is stable for all P and all Q. So I'm not sure what the consequences of this are vis-a-vis Igor Klebanov and his belief in bosonic M theory. In principle, I think this means he's supposed to start working on it now. But I'm not going to hold him to it. However, If you consider a more general compact space, different things can happen. In particular, let's imagine a product where we don't even specify what the individual items of the product are, just that we have a product manifold. Einstein's equations relate the various length scales. And consider this particular mode. It's a very particular example. Basically, it just corresponds to the metric on one of the two compact spaces shrinking while the other one grows. It is of the form of one of these guys, so you can substitute it in. And you find that its mass is this, minus 2 times p minus 1 squared over q minus 1, which maybe more interestingly is 8 over q minus 1 times the Brayton-Lohner-Friedman mass, which is a very curious result. It means that for these product spaces, the BF bound is violated for any product if the total dimension of the compact product space is less than 9. This is a Q and this is a 9. Sorry, they look like each other. But that not this is not necessarily true if the dimension is 9 or greater. In fact, if the product is a sphere, one can quickly show that it's stable to perturbations if the compact space total dimension is 9 or greater. This is sort of funny. This comment, I think, needs an arrow connecting it to what it's discussing. It's not the unstable case, but rather the stable case that has no realization in string theory just because it only happens for dimensions that are just sufficiently big enough that we can't do it.
Do you include the case of n equals 1?
N equals 1. No. N equals 1 would correspond to one of them being a circle.
Yes.
And if it's a circle, then it's not. It can't be an Einstein space with positive curvature. And then it would not satisfy the original equations of motion. Because you really need all of these things to be equal. And if this is 0, it can't be equal to the others. So this is very curious. And we have no reason, no intuitive or otherwise reason, why this should be a sort of critical dimension for the stability of these product spaces. It's sort of intriguing that it's just big enough that it doesn't happen in string theory or M theory. I'm not convinced one way or another whether it has any deep significance or whether it's just a consequence of the numbers that happen to crop up in the BF bound. So are there questions at this point?
About the ES3 cross S3.
Excuse me?
About the ES3 cross S3.
ADS3 cross S3? Well, what do you mean, what about it?
Is it just a line?
Three is less. Well, no, wait, no, no. The sum of the two. So we're dividing the compact space MQ into itself a product. We've introduced this new N, and so the Q-dimensional compact space, in fact, resolves into a product of two or more other compact spaces. Okay.
Let's do something like the T4 and the S3.
Okay, this is again different because the T4 is not an Einstein space.
What about ADS3 times S3 times S3?
ADS3 times S3 times S3 would in fact be unstable.
But it's not okay. It exists, you can make it, and it has a Google description. So
where do you make that? That's a nine-dimensional theory?
Now times a circle if you want.
Okay, well, unless, I mean, this analysis indicates that there's an instability in that. Unless the presence of the circle makes things different. I don't know why it would, but...
Well, you can take zero mode for the circle and you can do this analysis, right?
Then
there's
an instability.
Yeah,
more
for sure.
Sorry,
you need a six-form
theory
to realize that.
Yeah, there's no whole form.
Oh, okay.
That's...
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, all this does assume that there is a field strength of the same dimension as the total compact space, or alternately a field strength with the same dimension as the ADS space.
I mean, if there's an N-form field strength, then you can
build. Yes, that is different. Good. Okay. Mm-hmm. Any more questions? Okay. So these are the sort of the major results. I have a few interesting cases that we also studied, one of which is the solution of massive type 2A. When Romans first discussed this theory, he also noted that it had an ADS4 cross S6 solution. One can generalize this to any compact space. There are, of course, other fields in massive 2A, but we only write down the ones that we're interested in. So besides gravity and a field strength, there's also sort of an effective cosmological term, but all of these things also couple to a dilaton. So this C is an exponential of the dilaton with a certain coefficient. One can still find a solution. The solution is basically just turning off the dilaton and going ahead and solving the equations. And the fact that one has an additional equation, the dilaton equation of motion, sets the parameter of the cosmological constant in terms of the others, or maybe it's better to say sets all the other parameters in terms of the cosmological constant. So it's sort of interesting to wonder whether this, which is also a non-supersymmetric background, is perturbatively stable. So we went through the analysis. Now, in this case, when you fluctuate the coupled scalars that we examined before, the graviton traces and the particular mode of the field strength, you find that the fluctuation of the dilaton is also sourced. So you get a 3x3 system. It's conceptually the same, just a little more complicated to deal with. And you find three towers of masses. This one and then this one with a plus sign or a minus sign, and you find that the minus branch, in fact, can violate the Brighton-Lohner-Friedman bound. For example, if the compact space is S6, then there are two modes that lie under the bound. So this background is actually unstable.
Do you know you have to choose minus sign there?
Excuse me?
Do you know that you have to choose minus sign there?
Have to choose minus sign here?
Yeah.
You have both. I'm sorry. There are three towers of masses. So you have one tower with the plus sign and one tower with the minus sign. So remember, we had a 3x3 matrix of fluctuation, so you get something for all three. In general, for some generic compact space, lambda lies somewhere in this not particularly illuminating range, then you find an instability. And I think this is generic. We looked at it for products of spheres, and it seems like most cases have an unstable mode.
Can I ask a related question?
Sure.
Suppose you take, I know we give ADS5 cross S5. Let's say it's the orbifold model gauge theory that Silverstein and Kotschru looked at.
Okay.
Where you take the supergravity, ADS results from the N equals 4 super Yang Mills boundary conformal field theory. And do as they do, it orbifold that.
Mm-hmm.
The S5 in such a way that you break the supersymmetry.
Mm-hmm.
So then you'll have some gravity theory.
Mm-hmm.
It's not supersymmetric, but in addition, you have a dilaton. I think if you truncate it to the gravity sector, your results would predict that the gravity sector would be stable.
I think that's true.
But if you include the dilaton, would it continue to be stable?
Why does the dilaton couple in special here? I mean, you're talking about an orbifold that does not produce a tachyon, right?
I think that's correct.
Okay.
But you would still have a dilaton. Because
you would still have a dilaton.
The gauge theory would still have.
But okay, so the difference in the case that I'm talking about here is that there's this cosmological term.
Right.
The dilaton couples to the cosmological term.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And the cosmological term plays a role in the background. It's part of what supports
the
ADS background. In the other case with a generic dilaton, it would just essentially be an additional field that you'd added that would not couple in to this system because it wasn't involved in the background. So it would just descend to a massless scalar and a tower of massive modes.
I would expect that at some loop level it would actually run away for standard reasons.
Well, sure.
That's really interesting. I mean the question about whether it runs away or not is interesting. But it's beyond his analysis.
Yeah, it's definitely beyond his analysis. So I just wanted to remark, it's natural to wonder whether there's any interpretation of this system. Massive 2A, of course, is the background of D8 brains, and this is the right dimensionality to think that it might be related to a D2 brain or a stack of D2 brains in a D8 background, which is also unstable. The analogy is not perfect, however, since this system should have a running dilaton in the background. Well, the solution that I considered does not. And also, this system is actually unstable in the sense that it doesn't even have a classical solution around which there are tachyonic instabilities, but rather it is not a solution of the equations of motion. So I'm not sure whether there is an analogy here. I know that that's being looked at by Bergman and Brandhuber. And there was earlier analysis of the actual D4, D8 near horizon system by Brandhuber and Oz. This is an ADS6 fibered over an S4 in massive 2A with the dilaton turned on. So it's a lot more of a complicated background, and it's, of course, supersymmetric since the relative dimension of the brains is 4. So I just wanted to throw that out.
Where would the D2 run away? I mean, the D8 brain is like a domain like the pins trying to know all the pins are the same.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, I guess that's a good point. One might interpret that as being the reason why this doesn't have a tadpole. Mm-hmm. It just has an instability that doesn't care about which direction the instability takes you. That's a good point. So I just have one more topic to discuss, which is recent work relating to systems with a bare cosmological constant and the so-called N-bound. And just to review this N-bound very quickly, if I say anything that's less than true, I'm sure Raphael will correct me. So a little while ago, Tom Banks speculated about spaces with positive cosmological constant, and in particular, since there's an entropy associated to de Sitter space, which looks like 1 over the cosmological constant up to some factors, he was led to speculate that theories with a positive cosmological constant have a finite number of degrees of freedom, that number of which is in fact determined by that cosmological constant. So it becomes not an effective parameter, but a fundamental parameter. Moreover, one can see, if you, for example, add a black hole, that involves some entropy, but the entropy in the de Sitter horizon shrinks, so you still have a total conservation. And so Banks speculated that this was true for all spaces that were de Sitter, at least at late times. Raphael Busso, who is here, attempted to extend this to all solutions that involved a positive cosmological constant, feeling that if this lambda was really a fundamental parameter of the theory associated with the number of degrees of freedom, then that statement should not depend on the particular background that you choose to examine. So he hypothesized that this might be true, that the entropy is bounded by this number of degrees of freedom, which goes like 1 over lambda, for all spaces, even if lambda doesn't dominate at late times or indeed at any times. And Raphael gave a limited proof of this that assumed spherical symmetry, proved that it was true in some cases, some slightly counterintuitive cases there.
However,
yes, Lubos.
You have very precise numbers here, like 3 pi over lambda.
So well, that's the only
precise. 7 dimensions, right?
They don't what?
They are going in 4 dimensions. So
you're correct, of course, yes. Excuse me. So a potential counterexample to the N-bound was hypothesized by Rob Myers. And this is, he pointed out, that even if you have a bare cosmological constant, which sort of wants to push you in the direction of de Sitter space, if you also have flux, you can turn on enough flux to overwhelm the bare cosmological constant and get a solution that is, in fact, anti-de Sitter times a sphere. And once you have anti-de Sitter space, it doesn't have any of the properties that de Sitter space has that make it seem to respect this bound. In particular, you could put matter in the form of an arbitrarily large black hole in there. It can do whatever it likes, and then the entropy can go much above the generalization of this bound to arbitrary dimensions. So one thing that Raphael and I have been wondering is whether it could be that once you have an ADSP cross SQ solution with a bare cosmological constant, that this could be unstable, perhaps. There's a reason to believe that this might be true simply because it came so close to instability generically for the lambda equals zero case. So one can do this. Like I said, there is a solution where one compensates for the cosmological constant by turning on a strong flux of the field strength that you chose. Now, unlike the massive 2A case, where one also had a dilaton equation of motion, which fixed the other parameters in terms of the bare cosmological constant, here there's no such thing. So the ratio of the bare cosmological constant to the other length scales is a free parameter. We can choose this alpha to be whatever we like. And go ahead and do the analysis with arbitrary alpha. First of all, you find that everything I told you except the coupled scalar sector is exactly the same as it used to be. And in the coupled scalar sector, well, Once again, you have a 2x2 matrix, which needs to be diagonalized, except now the cosmological constant is cropping up. And also, this particular lambda bar is related to familiar lambda eigenvalue, the spherical harmonics, by something that includes the bare cosmological constant.
So, can you embed this into string theory, or is it just some...
Well, is there a bare cosmological constant in string theory?
I mean, you say unlike massive 2A, right? So it's massive 2A is something that belongs to the broad and theory picture, right?
Yes.
Do you believe in an unspecified gravitational theory?
This is an unspecified gravitational theory, that's right.
As are all everything in this discussion, because these guys are always talking about positive cosmological constant.
I mean, part of the point of this exercise of showing that there's a maximal entropy where you have a positive cosmological constant is to maybe say that it's not a coincidence that a positive cosmological constant is not seen in the current theory avatar.
Right. So this was done. It's even more tedious than the previous analysis. I won't take you through it, but this is the expression for the mass all the way at the bottom of the lower tower, which again goes down before it comes back up again. And what you can show is that if you turn on even an infinitesimal bare positive cosmological constant, that the mass at the bottom is equal to, this is just the BF bound, and then plus a negative definite contribution. So even for infinitesimal bare cosmological constant, the curve moves below the Brayton-Lohner-Friedman bound. And moreover, one can show that this function has no extrema as you vary the cosmological constant. So as you turn it higher and higher, it just moves monotonically all the way down to minus infinity, with the states getting more and more tachyonic. So this is actually very nice for the N bound. It seems we've shown that all these backgrounds with a positive bare cosmological constant are unstable. And that is generically true. However, there's one problem which we still have not resolved to our satisfaction, which is the fact that it's not necessarily true that because this curve goes below the bound, that there is a physical state sitting on that curve that went below the bound with it. Recall that when we didn't have a cosmological constant for the sphere, for example, whether or not the dimension of the compact space was even or odd determined whether a state sat at the minimum. If it's odd and we turn on a little cosmological constant, then that state will go right below the bound, and you immediately have an instability which persists for all values of the cosmological constant. So for Q odd, we've shown that these are unstable perturbatively. But for Q even, it seems that there is some window between 0 and some critical lambda where the lowest states, which are not all the way at the bottom of this curve, have not yet moved below the bound. So it seems like for only the even case, there is a small window that we have not yet been able to show is unstable for any reason. So
possibly. I mean, quantum mechanically, you'd be hard-pressed to say why you don't generate.
Right, but we're trying to make statements about gravity that we don't associate yet, at least, a particular quantum completion to.
Right.
So indeed, it could turn out to be true that maybe the N bound, if it is true, is only true in something that you can actually find a concrete realization of in M theory or the finite number of degrees of freedom generalization thereof. But for the moment, at least, it would be nice to make statements just about anything that looks like gravity at sufficiently low energies.
I want to ask, actually, if Raphael has any more spin to put on this.
On the question?
Well, this, on this
question. What's the data bound apparently violated?
Well, I should let Oliver put all his spins first, and then I can still make more comments.
There are more questions. This is my last transparency, except for conclusions.
I
am basically done, except just saying how surprising it is that this seems to depend so much on whether the compact space is even or odd dimensional. That seems very strange. And to point out that we have at least ruled out an infinite number of counterexamples to the N band, with only a small number left.
Even in the case of instability,
mean, that might make you feel better, but your argument didn't depend on the stability or instability.
So this was one comment that I was going to make. Even for the odd case, we're not done, because we have to also show that the background decays fast enough that you don't have a chance to, you know, put in somehow enough entropy to, you know. And that also then refers to your question, because if it was a non-perturbative instability, then it seems very implausible that the background would decay fast enough to avoid, you know, having an enormous amount of entropy for enough time to actually observe it, which is really the criteria that one should use. On the other hand, the fact that there are there's this range for even Q where for small lambda you have stability apparently isn't automatically a disaster, because it's good that it's for small lambda. The bound goes like an inverse positive power of lambda. And so that means that just to have ADS cross S doesn't have any entropy in it yet. You actually all have to put a big black hole in it or some form of entropy. And the fact that this is a bound, you know, where you have to be below a critical value of lambda to have stability means you have to put an enormous amount of entropy in. So you really have to sit down and check explicitly a solution with, say, a big black hole in it and see what happens there, whether there's any way that can push you sort of over the...
That might turn out to be unstable.
That might be unstable.
It's not unstable because the big black hole is still localized. And this is just discussing masses of the state particle that's far away from the black hole.
Yeah, if I knew the answer to that, it would have been included in the talk. But
No. But that can't be enough.
Well, I mean, we'll have to think about it. I have this prejudice that if somebody doesn't go away...
Some space-time, yeah. It's perturbatively stable.
Yeah.
You put in a local object, it's going to, like ice mine, be stable.
Yeah. Well, why can't you have a mode
put
that's
in a
localized
in
near that?
Yeah,
sorry? It's unstable.
Well, but that only... It might be built near it.
Yeah.
But surely,
yeah, that would
vacuum
decay
as a whole. The space as a whole isn't going to decay.
Well, but it would be sufficient if this space decays near the object that you put in, because that's where you would see entropy.
But that would be a decay of the object.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that doesn't matter.
The object would decay to something, you wouldn't lose the entropy.
Well, that I mean, if this decay induces a decay of the space and that just grows out to infinity, then yes, you would, because you just...
I just find it hard to imagine that you have a space-time which perturbatively is stable. Put in the black hole and it's sort of like, then you create a false vacuum. It would have to be, if it's perturbatively stable, it means that there's no, well so it could have, quantum mechanically, I suppose, be a false vacuum.
Well, you really have to have full analysis. I mean, you know, you calculate whatever the modes are for a particular background. It's not the same background anymore.
Black hole is a
and then
local
there might be a million other effects. Like the temperature of the black hole.
But it's not.
It is bigger than the ADS radius, but
yeah.
Presumably there is still some plenty of space out near infinity where it's sort of away from the black hole.
That's right. But I'm not too worried about that. I mean, if I wanted to see all that entropy, it's at the black hole, not at infinity. So, but I don't have an answer to that. That's a good question. And it would be ironic, though, if it's that little window after eliminating. It's possible.
No, but I don't understand what that. I mean, your argument, you can use stability for the code, just assume there was a stable background.
Right. My argument was so it would be intriguing if you know a much more non-trivial. Set of processes predicted the bound than the one that. So for example, also you can see that the bound is protected in certain situations where you don't have spherical symmetry and where these causal diamonds get areas that are arbitrarily large. So they give you a sufficient condition for checking that the bound is definitely satisfied in some space times, but that you know might go completely wrong and the bound is still satisfied. An example of that is ADS2 cross S2, for example, where the area of these diamonds diverges, but it's immediately clear from the geometry that the bound is still okay. So there's no such example known in four dimensions.
If you had a CFT corresponding to this structure, you could just see putting a black hole basically and warming it up.
Yes.
And you could just, I mean, it would be a very weird phenomenon to have instability. I mean, you have something.
Yeah, we did think for a bit about whether just putting in a black hole could make it unstable. And it seems like something that simple is not going to, in fact, be the answer, because we know that spaces with black holes are stable. And from the point of view of a black hole in anti-de Sitter space, it doesn't necessarily know that there is a compact space with a bare cosmological constant. It just knows it's sitting in ADS with some particular value of the ADS length scale and some particular modes. And we know that large black holes in that case are stable.
No, in the cases where you have instability, do you have any more thoughts on what it's unstable to? Eventually?
Not really.
Gary has thoughts. We don't have
thoughts. What's the mode that's unstable?
Yeah, what's the mode?
It's one of the modes that couples the traces of the two compact spaces to the compact and the ADS space to the flux.
So one space is blowing up.
Yeah. Water is getting smaller. Yeah, exactly. And the flux is changing also. Yeah. So at least you're right. At least linearly, one is getting bigger. And of course, since it's a local maximum, you can go either way, it seems, at least to begin with. So maybe the ADS space gets much bigger, or maybe it gets much smaller.
So whenever you say flux is changing, but you mean just the field strength is changing.
The intuition that one might have from other examples with positive cosmological constant, where you have sort of space times that are on the tip of the hill, is that you typically get a local evolution into locally just a Sitter space, or locally a collapse into a singularity, depending on which way you go, wherever you are.
How would it fit into Sitter space? You have a
You just come back Well, you can always grow a bubble. The De Sitter space just grows within itself. It doesn't.
And
destroy
the boundary? So you think it can
destroy
asymptotics?
Sorry?
I think it can destroy the ideas asymptotics.
Yeah, what happens when this moves out to the boundary is a good question. And I don't know what more to say there, but I would say that it destroys the ideas asymptotics.
Why is it a local phenomenon? You just have a vacuum. How do you don't see a local?
It may not be local. I mean, I'm just saying there are examples where you can see even locally that it can go in different directions. So, depending on which direction you perturb, might be that the entire space time collapses into a singularity, or that the entire space time becomes asymptotically De Sitter space, not necessarily in terms of the global topology, but in terms of everything. It's important to understand which of these things actually happens in detail to see whether there's enough time to violate the bound. So that's an important question.
Well, why don't I go ahead and conclude? So.
Right, so again,
then we play the black hole.
Yeah.
All right, so we've showed that ADSP cross SQ with zero bare cosmological constant is perturbatively stable all the time, regardless of the dimensions. Showed that the coupled scalar sector either saturates or virtually saturates the bound for any compact space. Potential instabilities can arise not from the really complicated scalar sector, but from the seemingly innocent modes of the graviton of both indices on the compact space. An example of that was we showed that this product of Einstein manifolds was a compact space is unstable for sufficiently low dimension. Putative CFT duals we investigated a little bit. The spectra of conformal dimensions are all unusual. They don't rule out their existence. then again, it's equally possible that in sufficiently large dimensions, nature just does not guarantee us a quantum theory of gravity, and therefore does not guarantee us a CFT dual. So that's also a possibility. We looked at a couple generalizations. Lambda's greater than zero, found that almost all of these backgrounds are unstable. The Roman's massive 2A background is also unstable. And I guess the lesson to take home, you know, we're string theorists, we do so much with supersymmetry, we're used to ascribing everything good that happens to supersymmetry, but in this case, we found an example of something, especially something that has a classical description in the gravity side that is not supersymmetry and yet still has some pretty properties. So, thanks a lot.